man, I got you on here, but it's quiet. Let me boost your level. Okay, let's hear you say something.
Something.
Perfect. Welcome to episode number 2 of The Ad Brief, the weekly podcast of the adland.tv website. This week's episode, We Are the Sherlockians, where we start to delve into strategy and how to apply it. We love to hear what you think, either in comments on the site or in ratings on iTunes. Ratings are how people find us, so if you like the podcast, maybe you can give us a few stars. And a little bit of site news, the Super Bowl is coming and there are still sponsorship opportunities available. It's Adland's highest traffic day of the year. So if you're in a business that would benefit from ad people's eyeballs, maybe a production house, commercial printer, or photographer, a Super Bowl sponsorship could set you up for the whole year, and it costs a lot less than you'd think. Just click the Advertise on Adland link at the bottom of each page. So here we go, episode number 2 of the Ad Brief, We Are the Sherlockians. So where does that music from, by the way? I love it. I love how it sounds, at least.
Okay, it's the James Ketting, he's German, Ghana Field Recordings. So he actually recorded postal workers at the University of Accra in Ghana as they're stamping letters going out. So that's them making a lot of whistling noises and stamping the mail.
So like that percussion is them just doing their job.
Yeah, it's to make it less boring.
That's awesome. So what would that sound like if we were, what would that sound like if we recorded concepting, if we did concepting that way?
Lots of crumpled paper, scamp papers going into the bin. That I don't think that would sound very good.
No, let's leave it to the postal workers.
Yeah.
So for episode 2, we wanted to be a little bit more on point and kind of get a little bit more educational, but also talk about new stuff. And one thing that's kind of cool is we just got a new piece of technology here in the office.
Oh, yeah. You told me about this, the Leap.
Yeah, the Leap. So, you know, this is kind of like a new thing instead of a mouse. It's a little box that would sit in front of your computer. And I've got one. Post a picture of it. But it's about 2 inches by 1 inch, and it kind of sits right in front of your computer. And it's got cameras in it that can watch your hand. So basically the idea is you can hover your hand over it in space without a mouse. So it's more like Minority Report than multi-touch. So you can kind of make a pinch gesture in space in front of your computer to control your computer.
You can call your computer a loser.
Yeah. You can make an L with your fingers and then the computer knows how you feel about it.
Yeah.
So it's really early on with this thing and they're trying to create an app store for it and they're trying to get, you know, developer support behind it. And of course we're looking at it like, you know, what could we do in the branding world with this thing? You know, what could be interesting, you know, to help invent or create for people.
This sounds really, really cool. So, I mean, is it like you could speak American Sign Language to it?
Yeah, right. No,
I mean, I think that would be not great. Just pinch gestures, but you could use certain signs as shorthand for open Photoshop or, you know.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's like taking gestures to actual language and hey, that's a good idea. Maybe that should be our app. We'll make a sign language reader that lets you control your computer. Forget you said that.
Okay, done.
We'll take that. No, it's a really neat pizza kit, and we don't know, you know, what we're going to end up doing with it. You know, looking at the market a little bit for it, it's desktop, which, you know, I know 90% of people are still, 90% of the internet is still consumed on desktop computers, but the sort of software market, I don't know how. Like, do we sell it in the App Store? Do we give you something that you download and use? And how many people have these things? But no, I think sign language control from your computer could be a really cool idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think it could be cool to make games for little children on it because you don't want their grubby little jam-filled germy hands all over your keyboard.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, kids learned the iPad so quick and so easy where if it was a physical gesture that makes sense to them, that's built in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they get swiping, they get dragging. So hopefully, you know, maybe they'll get doing that in the air and then you really have something. Or just teaching your kids
that sign. I had a friend that told me that he had a baby and they let the baby play with the iPhone forever. And then they were over at somebody's house and the baby is still just a baby. And they show him a digital photograph and the kid swipes it because he's like expecting it to do something. And they were just like, mind blown. This kid is expecting stuff. It's like that internet video that was going around the web for a while. There was a baby that insisted the magazine didn't work because it didn't work like the iPad. She was swiping pages in a magazine and it didn't.
And it didn't change.
It didn't change. And it's like, you could flick the pages. It feels kind of silly, but yeah. They really adapt quite quickly to this sort of thing.
Yeah, our kids live in the future, even if we don't.
I know.
But, you know, thinking about that leap thing and the approach of concepting for it, it kind of made me think about how we've all approached concepting in ads for a long time. That, you know, I know when I was a creative, it was kind of like, here's your brief, now go think of something. And there isn't really any process of how to do that. What's been your experience as far as concepting? Something similar? Have you ever worked with people who said, here's
what I've actually worked with people who knew how to write briefs because I've worked in the UK. Not to say that they're all better over there, but there's been a lot of people who knew briefs there, you know, where everybody would have to sign off on this brief. So it was initialed by like 120 people of top brass. So there was no confusion.
So when you get the brief, what's your process of coming up with ideas?
Oh, well, the process of coming up, to me, the brief was like the most important thing because as I worked in other countries, you wouldn't get the brief. And then my process became make a brief. And so the brief like starts with three questions. Are we expanding market or are we expanding the brand share? I told you about the Pampers, right?
Yeah.
The diapers, they can't really expand the brand share when they already own 70%. So that's why they changed the word babies to kids. And now they're expanded market because now 5-year-olds can walk around in diapers. So that's the first question you have to ask. And then the second question is, do you want trial or do you want increased consumption? So, I mean, so the difference is, are we going to drink coffee 7 times a day? You know, are we introducing Starbucks at night thing, the caffeine-free late night Starbucks or, you know, That would be increasing the consumption.
And can we get kids to drink Starbucks so they need more diapers?
Yeah, exactly. That would really expand the market because everybody knows what coffee does to your bowels. But then the other thing you have to ask is, are we doing USP or like, do we have a USP or are we branding? Because we're the same. I mean, branding is like, okay, we're a soda pop that tastes like all the other soda pops. So that would be branding. But there are actually still USPs around. I mean, take a brief that I've actually seen. I've seen the brief for Tango in the 90s, which came with a tagline, you know when you've been tangoed. And in that brief, I mean, it's like a Fanta type orangey soda pop. It's just that it tastes a lot more orangey than other soda pops. And I know that taste is subjective and all that, but the one word proposition in that brief was hit.
Yeah.
So you ended up with these weird ads of this orange guy that would go and slap people in the face. And you could only see him if you went in a slow motion rewind, because he ran that fast and slapped people when they drank their Tango. And so you are saying, it's a lot more orangey than Fanta, because Fanta is music in your mouth. What on earth does that even mean?
It dances on your tongue.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what that means.
It's bubbly is what it means. But so even on something as, you know, that doesn't really have anything to say differently than other things, because soda pop is just soda pop, you do have USPs in different areas to sell on.
Yeah, and even in that example where the soda pop is just soda pop, you're kind of saying that the Tango fills some need for you if your need is to have somebody slap you with flavor. You know, but it still is. That's the job that it's done. Is like when you're drinking something, you're going to go and drink something that you're going to want to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of figuring out sort of there's a guy who writes a lot about startup stuff. His name's Clay Christensen. His first book was The Innovator's Dilemma. And then he's got another one called Jobs to Be Done. And I think it's really interesting to look at the startup space as, you know, a way of sort of vetting ideas, because when you're pitching a company, it's basically an idea. one idea in it. You know, it can be a multivaried, complex kind of monster of an idea, but it's basically they're concepting against a business problem, very similar to a brief, and then they are, you know, presenting their solution against it. And what's kind of cool is if you start looking at the startup space, there's kind of been, if you think about it, in the last maybe even 3 and 5 years, the biggest kind of cultural shift ideas came out of startups. They used to come out of ads. You know, we knew it. Like the Budweiser frogs kind of impacted all of culture. Even like What's Up was creating culture. And a lot of people still think that kind of the role of advertising is to create culture at its highest form. I know it's a big deal about, you know, John Jay from Wieden and Kennedy starting a whole new agency. And that's his whole view is he's starting agency to create culture. But I think in the last few years, we've seen that coming from startups. Like Instagram is kind of a similar place that an ad used to take. It's something, you know, it's very pervasive and a part of culture and changes your view. But when the guys went to create it, they had a much different process than we would have. You know, there wasn't a copywriter looking at YouTube videos to figure out how to do Instagram.
When you were saying creating culture, I was just thinking that, and these days all we do is harvest YouTube videos and take the funniest laughs from Reddit and stick it in an ad, which I've seen for more than 10 years. I mean, that started a long time ago, because I remember badlanding some early Southwest ads in like 2001 or 2000, because they had ripped funny web videos off the web, and that's back when you had to like get them off Nutella or whatever it was called.
Oh yeah, or Ebaum's World.
Ebaum's World, he rips everything from everywhere, but okay, yeah, Ebaum's World.
Right, it's just ripping from, I mean, it's cultural scavenging, and it's, yeah. You know, borrowing interest. So as a creative, we want to present ourselves to the world that we're coming up with these ideas, at least to our boss, if nothing else. And, you know, and I think there is a lot of value to the idea that we are creating something original. But now what we're doing originally is finding the right videos. That seems to be our job. Is like
you know
said,
what? I think this
scavenger.
Like I think this is actually a bit of a problem that stems from desktop publishing. Before, when it was really expensive, you would actually marker rough and show the clients marker roughs.
Yes.
And the clients had to use their brains to understand the concept. And then everybody suddenly had their own computers, and art directors turned into studio personnel. And then we had to mock it up. And so we're getting actual pictures. And this happened to me once. I worked for a beauty type product thing, and I was branding perfumes and whatnot. So I had to use photographs that already existed and cut them together, sort of like cut and paste, and to show what I wanted the finished ads to look like. So I cut some hair from one and a model from one and background from one, and I, you know, mashed it all together in a layout. And I was in a bit of a hurry, so I cut the ear wrong. You know, I just kind of, you know, I didn't really sort of like concentrate on cutting the ear perfectly. I just cut it.
So it was and, a bingo ad.
Yeah, it was a quick layout. This is what it's going to look like. So, you know, here's the sunset and the hair is like this big and she has, she has this dress on. And the client actually spent 10 minutes discussing her ears. And I was like, seriously? Are you serious? You do realize I'm not actually going to use the Revlon model here. You know, and can we get somebody with bigger eyes? I'm like, this woman is not going to be used by us. She is contracted to Revlon. We're not using this woman. You need to use your brains now. This is a mock-up, you know?
So
I did what anybody would do. I went straight back to marker roughs. Everything I presented after that was marker roughs.
And then people said, so we're going to do our ad in marker?
Yeah, they were like, is this the collage style we're doing? Is this the marker rough we're doing? And I'm like, no, you have to use your imagination. I'm getting this model, show photograph of model, to pose like this, show marker rough. And then they had to think, and I sold through many more ads that way.
I think that's a good point too, is that when you put yourself in the client's perspective, they don't always understand what it is we're asking them to approve or what it is we're asking them to buy.
Yeah.
And you know, what is the right sort of way to present that. You know, ultimately it always comes down to the best idea winning. Sometimes that idea gets formed in the client's head without separately from what we've presented, and then we've sort of lost that opportunity in this case, you know, the client thinks they have the best idea and that's what moves forward. So we have to be really clear in how we're presenting and what we're presenting.
Yeah, exactly. It's like whenever you actually present close to finished layouts and you have Laura Mipsum in the headlines, the clients, I mean, this is like an old joke or it happened, but they've said that clients have pointed out that not everybody reads Latin.
Right.
And it's like, wow, it's a Laura Mipsum headline. I don't even think that you would go that far, though, to present without the headlines written. That seems a bit weird to me, but I've heard that told many a time.
Well, we just finished a medical app, and we ran into that same thing. We had Greek copy in there, and they thought it was – we were just diverging to the Latin for a second. You know, we had to kind of explain it.
Yeah, that's one of the art director wisdom jokes I've pulled on Twitter. Nobody reads copy unless it's Laura Mipsum.
Yeah, then they pour over it completely.
Yeah.
But along the lines of kind of – you know, that process of coming up with ideas and making sure that you have a good idea and that you're presenting it well. You know, Guy Kawasaki, he's kind of like a startup counselor guy. He is also a venture capitalist, so he hears a lot of people pitch their business ideas. And he sort of has said, okay, look, here is a format that will help you be more successful when you pitch. And he basically he's got a blank PowerPoint that's out there that you can just fill out, which I love this idea that it's like, you know, we're so good at coming up with random ideas, but as soon as you give yourself almost like a Mad Libs or a worksheet and say, I need to fill out an idea for this, it gives focus to your thinking and it makes it kind of gives you more room actually to have bring your twist to it, to bring your life experience and your approach to the business to it. The key thing that I think from his template, and you know, you can go out and find it or we can link to it, but he says basically a pitch comes down to this. Tell me the way the world is, what's bad about it, tell me the pain point, and then tell me the way the world should be. And then the last step is, how are you going to make that happen? How does your product then get me to that? So it's kind of this really quick three-step process. And I think, you know, as we're talking about solving problems for brands, that is the key question that we can be solving for brands is, number one, what is the pain? Now, sometimes that pain is a business pain, like in your Pampers example. So if they're coming to them and saying, our pain is we're not selling enough diapers.
Yeah.
It's important to figure out, to rephrase that and say, okay, look, I get that. I know that's why we're working together and that's what we're going to help you solve. Let's get that off the table because that can't be what the ad is about. Although we'd like to live in that world sometimes, right, where we just tell people buy more. It'd be so easy to create a
solution. Yeah, but their solution was quite ingenious. I mean, it was just we can't make more kids. Let's just make sure the kids wear diapers longer.
Longer, yeah. That's the thing is they said, you know what? In this world, we are feeling so much pressure. This is kind of the insight is we feel so much pressure to potty train our kids and feel like they need to be these perfect kids. And it's competitive. I want my kid to be potty trained before my nephew was, before the other kids at school were. You know, it's sort of like a rank thing that you pride yourself on as a parent. But at the same time, we're probably getting them off of diapers before they're done with it. And, you know, maybe the insight was, I don't know if this happened with your daughter, but mine, you know, just had a bedwetting stretch where, you know, she was already potty trained, but then when she was like 3.5, 4 years old, just started wetting the bed. You know, maybe it was, we didn't make her go potty before she went to bed or whatever, but I was kind of like thankful that they had diapers for bigger kids at that point.
Yeah.
So if those didn't exist, the way the world is now is you potty train your kid till they're two. They wet the bed when they're four. There's nothing you can do about it. So the way the world should be is we're comfortable talking about this. We know it's a journey and we can have products filling that. And so now we've taken their need, which was sell more diapers, as kind of just a market goal. Let's get some more share here. Let's take share from those guys. Let's increase our day parts or whatever. That's the functional goal. But we have to always take that and phrase that in the human terms of who's going to use it.
Yeah.
And that's what's so cool about that framework of that Guy Kawasaki came up with is, you know, if you're doing a startup and it's Instagram, it's like, look, I'm taking pictures of my friends, but I want to share them and I want them to look cool. So the way the world is my camera at the time when Instagram got started, my iPhone camera sucks. Pictures just don't look that cool. But we found out if we can put these filters on them, they remind us of those moments of when we, of the life we thought we would grow up with that we saw in our parents' pictures. And you see pictures of your parents where they have that giant belt buckle and the big, you know,
and that white frame and that washed out yellow color. Yeah.
And you feel like, I know I did as a kid. I felt like that was the world I would grow up to live in and that life would sort of look like that and that I would be able to share my life in that same way. In one sense, I was kind of robbed of that. The problem was now we just randomly share crappy snapshots on Facebook and blah.
Yeah, and our food. Yeah, no, but I mean, I think Instagram, because of the filters and the cropping, because I had a thing for Polaroids, like the shape of a Polaroid for the longest time. I had like the splash page on my personal website had every photo was cropped exactly like a Polaroid. And I built this little stupid HTML frame around it because it was like Polaroids ruled the world.
Yeah.
And that was kind of what they did. They cropped it, turned it into a Polaroid-like thing, and they had all those filters that actually made the crummy little camera work better. But now with their misstep in the terms of service, everybody sort of moved away from them. I quit Instagram instantly because it was just really, you know, photos of my friends' lattes aren't that interesting. And I had also 680 people following me, and I went to private, and I tried to delete these people, and you had to do it one at a time, and that just became a pain. So it was just quicker for me to delete the whole account.
Right.
So and that was I Am Now instead, if you've heard of them.
Which one?
I Am. It's spelled I and then E-M.
Oh. I'm using a different one. I'm using Google's, the Snapseed one. Which was a nice, you know, they said, hey, you know, we're just going to buy the photo thing and we already have Google Plus, so share them there. But it lets you spit it out to Facebook and Twitter. You know, the Instagram newsfeed was kind of the product in some way too, of where you could, you know, just go on and look at other people's photos all the time. I think that's, you know, another part that people enjoy about it. But that's it, within 2 years, we've seen them disrupt Facebook's photo sharing. So they came up with this really simple thing. It's just an app. Much simpler than Facebook, and it's just a stream of photos. There's no updates. It's a much simpler product, and it was made by 12 guys instead of 12,000 like Facebook. Mm-hmm. But then in that year that they were out, other people said, you know what? I'm two people, just me and a friend, and we're going to make different, better filters, and we're going to be, I don't know, you can't be cheaper than Instagram because it was free, but they're going to not have the privacy hangups, so they're going to be an even simpler version. We won't even have the feed. And now those guys are taking eating Instagram's lunch. But anyway, so Instagram was a $1 billion idea, and then, you know, somebody else came up with it and said, hey, I'm just going to make a $2 million idea, and if enough of those are out there, they kind of ate Instagram's lunch. What was interesting from the to take that to kind of bring that back to brands in general is what brand could have launched Instagram? Why wasn't Instagram from Kodak?
I know. Why wasn't it? That would have been ideal. Kodak. Why wasn't it from Polaroid?
Right. Because they're afraid of disrupting themselves. But now, you know, Polaroid is gone and Instagram was worth more than the entire Polaroid company.
And this disturbs me so much. I have like, I don't know, 27 Polaroid cameras. I'm still crying. I have one that was perfect. It spat out Polaroids the shape of business cards, and I have like the world's worst memory for faces. So what I used to do was take a Polaroid of them and slap it, glue it to my business card from them, and then I knew what they looked like.
Yeah, that's genius.
And why isn't this an app? Seriously. It's like, hi, who are you? Click. Good, now I have you here photographed in my thing because I have a shit memory for faces.
Yeah.
So if anybody ever runs into me and you've met me before and I kind of look like an idiot and go, what? Who? Huh? Who are you? Well, that's because I have a shit memory for faces.
No, it's because Polaroid went out of business. That's it.
That's it. Polaroid went out of business. It's their fault.
You got it. Well, that I think that brings back to a little bit more startup thinking too is so, you know, Guy Kawasaki gave us these three questions. How is the world now? What's the problem now? What's the pain point? How should it be? And what can we come up with for a brand that will address that? And then you can look at this jobs to be done thing. And, you know, this is a classic advertising kind of thing. I think almost he's taking something from the ad world and applying to startups, but there's the idea of, you know, don't sell me a hammer and nails, sell me on my picture being on the wall. Don't sell me an oil change, sell me my car driving properly. I don't care about oil in my car. I don't need oil. That's not a concern for me. I need that light to go off. I need my car to not be broken. And so the job to be done of Jiffy Lube isn't about oil. I don't care if you're changing my filter even. All I want to know about is how much are you extending the life of my car? That's really their job to be done. And the job to be done of Polaroid is still out there. Like you said, there's still a lot of really interesting uses of photos once you get them off of your phone. But for whatever reason, they're ignoring it or leaving it. Or maybe we just don't care. Why haven't you bought their current camera? You know, they make a camera that prints photos out of it.
Oh, my God. Why haven't I bought that? I need that.
It's like $300.
Why haven't I gotten a thing that I attach to my phone that prints photos out of it?
They make that, too. It's like a phone case.
Oh, I need that.
Yeah, apparently not, though.
I haven't seen it. I didn't know it existed. I'll have
bad
to get
distribution.
That.
Yeah, but they have these really miniature printers about the size of your phone. It's Bluetooth.
That's brilliant.
So you know, a picture could come right out of your purse and you could give it to somebody.
I need that.
Which is pretty cool.
Somebody has to gift that to me. I'm broke.
If we ever did show notes, we would put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
Give them a Polaroid and you'll post them a Polaroid.
Yeah. So, my latest latte, you know, with a little heart in it.
Yeah. It only could be a food. I don't know what the job to be done is of taking pictures of food. I guess it's to say I had this great moment and you weren't here.
I don't know. I mean, I started using food spotting years ago and I did it. I took a few pictures of really interesting foods that I was eating and I put them up on food spotting and I thought this is brilliant because now when I go to another city and I'm hungry, I can go to food spotting and I can find, you know, other people showing me what's good to eat. So I thought that was a great idea. But then I didn't really post any more pictures and food spotting didn't take off and everybody was busy posting their food on Instagram. So that seems like there was a great app that just didn't really that had a moment stolen from it via Instagram, actually.
You know what? I wonder if it was that food spotting had people taking pictures, but not enough. Nobody cares to actually look at your picture of food. I wouldn't seek out pictures of other people's lunch solely.
No, that's that. Yeah. But what you, it was a little bit bouncy or not functioning that well. I mean, there weren't that many people food spotting in Copenhagen where I was at the time. Mm-hmm. So I remember you just go, I'm here, where, and then you see the pictures that are nearby you. And since there's not that many taking pictures, you know, I saw something half a mile away and it was too expensive for me. But like the whole idea was that you could be in any city and just go, I'm here, and then you'd get photos of food around you and you'd figure out which one was tastiest to eat.
Oh, that's actually really smart.
It's a really good idea, yeah. It just didn't have enough users. I mean, it's the same thing, like Guala took over in Scandinavia faster than Foursquare did. And then when I came to Cannes, everybody I knew was Guala-ing. And when I came to Cannes, I discovered that Foursquare was advertising's favorite baby. And then I was like, oh, well, so Guala's going to die and Foursquare is going to live. So that's exactly what happened. But there were more people on Guala in Scandinavia, so it was a lot more fun to do Guala.
Mm-hmm.
So it is user base that really dictates where you're going.
Yeah, especially with Instagram in that sense of, you know, whatever pictures you were mostly hoping would be in your feed, you'd put up with the other, you know, sort of chaff to get a little bit of the wheat.
Yeah.
You know, and usually I was looking for pictures of chavs, which that's a British joke, right?
Funny.
Not very funny.
No.
It's interesting, you know, that jobs to be done topic. That guy, Clay Christensen, did a talk at TED, and he talked about some companies that really understand what their job to be done is. He talked about the furniture industry, and he said, you know, that like furniture, like low-margin furniture with, like, crummy product, it's really easy to copy. Anybody can pretty much do that and get a sleazy salesman and you're in business, right? But then there's places like Ethan Allen that said, oh, you know what we're going to do? We're going to be different. We're going to have expensive products with sleazy salespeople. And that worked for a while for them, but then they got copied and sort of there's no reason to go to them versus Restoration Hardware or somebody else with expensive stuff. But he said that really there's one company whose job to be done has never been copied. And they're so successful that the founder is the richest person in the world a lot of years. And that company's IKEA.
Uh-huh.
Which I know you're a huge fan of. And
no.
But they said, here's the job that IKEA has to be done. You just moved into a new place and you have no furniture. And every time that happens to you in your life, and that can happen multiple times, somebody in your life is going to say, let's just go to IKEA. And you can buy a whole room worth of stuff. And, you know, and sometimes you've outgrown that. You just don't want to do it again, or you're past that. And you graduated past that. But everybody kind of knows that that's the point. That's what their solution is. They're not just a blank furniture store. And, you know, once you've been in your apartment for 2 years, 3 years, you stop going.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just get a whole nother set of flat pack. MDF
but that
furniture.
Was their original idea, though, when they worked out in Sweden. He started selling, like, what, pens and wooden furniture, wooden bits and bobs, while he was still on a bike, and he would bike out catalog to people, and then he would take people's orders, and he would cycle back, and he'd get this stuff, and then he'd, you know, bike out the stuff for him. So, you know, this guy actually worked pretty hard. And then when it grew larger, it actually started the trend of use and wear it out and throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have very, very trendy furniture in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s that, you know, beanbags that you could use for a few years and then throw it out. So you would redo your living room. And this is like the first time people could actually do that. Instead of having like the same furniture for 50 years in the living room, they would actually change it and be trendy and stuff. And that's why it became such a, you know, instant apartment place. If you need to like start over somewhere and you need furniture, you go to IKEA.
And you could turn your blank, boring apartment into something that was trendy and cool for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Until the trends moved on. Well, isn't another Swedish company, H&M, the same
way? Yes. Yeah. It's pretty much the same way.
They kind of invented fashion.
Yeah, both IKEA and H&M are kind of started by knocking off other designers, like copying what other people were doing. And then, you know, they now have their own designers and they start their own trends rather than copying everybody else's. But their strength to begin with was getting trends done fast and on the high street. So if they saw something on, you know, the runway, they would copy the colors or the cut and have it on the high street cheap.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing you brought it up, because I was just out at this conference this week in San Francisco, and it was kind of an app-related conference. Just a weird little aside about it. It's this analytics tool that we bake into our apps. It's kind of like Google Analytics, if you've ever seen that. So it just basically tells you who's using your app and when. Completely propellerhead thing. And the keynote speaker was a banker from Goldman Sachs. And wow. As soon as I saw that, I was like, okay, yeah, I'm at the wrong conference. Or this isn't going to be what I thought it was going to be. I was expecting it to be, you know, a lot of geeks sharing tips on how they build stuff. But it was more about sort of they call it the mobile first conference. And the banker guy goes, you know what I think is going to be big? Smartphones.
No.
like he had invented that. And all of the people that they had speaking at this conference, none of them had a mobile optimized website at a conference called Mobile First.
You're kidding me.
So the conference was a little bit off. But speaking of H&M, there was a guy there who, you know, they just kind of said, here's a new guy who's doing something on mobile. He did an app first before he even did a website, and it's called Poshmark. And what they do is, here was his pitch, which I liked a lot. He said, fashion's a $1 trillion industry. 90% of that money goes to women's wardrobes. And of that, of all those clothes, 90% of them are just hanging in women's closets. They don't get worn. And so you go and you buy something for an event or, you know, a party, and you wear it once, and then you're always looking for a reason to wear it, or you feel like you need a new thing. So Poshmark lets you actually resell your clothes to other users of the app. You can take a picture of your clothes, post it on this site, and you know, once you get going for a while, you find somebody who's got a similar taste and similar figure to you, so you guys can start swapping clothes directly, and you know they're going to fit or look good. Or at least you can see her wearing them, because a lot of times they take a picture of themselves in the clothes. It's a pretty interesting model, and the whole time I'm watching it, I'm like, man, H&M should have done this.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Because now they're going to kind of, if this thing takes off, H&M are the people who are going to suffer, because you're going there for a $12 shirt that's going to be cool, and you're going to wear it twice, and then, like you said, throw it away. But if Poshmark becomes the way people start buying their clothes, H&M's kind of in trouble, don't you think?
I don't know. I mean, I've done the whole get a dress for one occasion and then sell it, because I like Karen Millen, and they're kind of expensive. So I got myself a gorgeous blue silk dress for Caffeine Goddess's wedding, right? Because I was the maid of honor. And how often am I going to wear that thing? You know, deep cleavage and puffy arms and all silk. Not very often. So I sold it immediately afterward to a woman who had the similar figure to me and lived a couple of towns away. So it was sent directly to her, and she wore it for a holiday party. And then she sold it. So that dress
still
went
going
to three different parties within, I don't know if it's still going, but it went to three different parties within a month.
Oh, that's great. I think that's really awesome. So you were doing Poshmark without the app. You did it through Craigslist or something, or eBay?
Yeah, I did it through the Swedish version of Craigslist.
Yeah. No, it's very cool. We had done we worked with a reseller here in town. They're a nonprofit. They're part of this group that supports foster kids. And so they kind of looked at the way the world is, and they said foster kids don't get any chance to feel special. They basically, you know, they're always like Harry Potter, living under the stairs and never feeling like they belong anywhere. And at school, everybody knows they're foster kids and they feel left out. So they created a store that had resale clothes. Kind of, you know, you see them like Plato's Closet. I don't know if you've seen that before, but they're just kind of resale shops for the college set. So it's newer clothes that's turning faster. They created a store called Refresh. And so, you know, the sort of the way the world, they think the world should be, is that foster kids should have an exclusive thing to do. So they built a DJ booth into there, and they built, they have a runway. And so these kids get to come in. They have nights when it's only the foster kids. And these are high school age kids, and they get to come in and try on all the clothes when nobody else is there. They get the pick of the newest stuff, and they do a fashion runway, and they have DJs, and it feels like a really cool exclusive thing for them. So that was their kind of solve for that. We did a website with them, and you know, one of the solutions we did on there was like this thing called Polyvore, where basically you can build outfits. Where I thought would be really interesting to take it is similar to the Poshmark thing, is just change people's attitudes towards clothes. What I really like about Poshmark, and like what you did too, is a lot of our clothes, we only need one or two wears out of them. So why did you bought your dress new because you wanted it to be the first, or because you knew you needed it for the wedding?
Yeah, I knew I needed it for the wedding. I mean, I was a maid of honor, and there were rules of colors.
Yeah.
So I had to go and get that color.
You didn't expect it to be on Craigslist.
No. Well, I tried that first, but because as there was a season before had a perfect color as well, but those I couldn't find any in my size.
Yeah, the solution isn't there for you.
So not only did I buy it new, I bought it before it was actually released, because I came to the store so often. They were like, "Well, this one's coming out soon," and I'm like, "Well, get me that one, because I need it now."
As you're saying that, I'm thinking I was in a wedding about 2 years ago. So I bought a suit thinking, oh yeah, I need a suit. I haven't worn it since.
Those are the things. I mean, you should be happy it wasn't tails.
Yeah. So along with Guy Kawasaki and Jobs to be Done, there was one other thing I wanted to bring up. I think the whole overall point of these kind of different ways of thinking about it is just that there are different ways of thinking about it. And when we sit down to concept, either, you know, whether even if you're on the client side and you're like, how am I going to ask my agency to do this? How am I going to bring this to them to get a solution? If you're, in planning and you're thinking, what can I write on this that the client's going to agree to and that I know I'm going to give the creative something they can execute against? Or as a creative, like, okay, now I have the brief. What's my process to come up with ideas? And everybody has theirs. Some people's is, I need a sheet of paper and 7 sharpened pencils, and then I need to watch 3 episodes of Adventure Time, and then,
and I need my lucky socks.
Right. And then I just sit there and wait for the idea. There's a book that came out a couple of years ago called Made to Stick. Have you heard about it?
Yeah, I reviewed it.
Oh, what do you think? What do you think of it?
I liked it.
Yeah, it's generally good. And the thing that blew my mind, that was like a mind-blown moment for me when I read it, because not only the first thing that blew my mind was there are characteristics of good ideas. You know, a lot of times in the ad biz, we don't know why we like an idea. We don't know if an idea is going to run. We don't know what shapes a great idea. And there have been so many times when I thought, okay, this is the Cannes Lion winner. It's like, life's downhill from here. I'll just release this one, gather in all the awards. Wow, was it that easy? Of course, nothing happens. Nobody liked it. It doesn't go anywhere. And then after reading this book, they basically said there are 6 characteristics of a good idea. They're looking at urban legends in the book, right?
Yeah.
So they're looking at just the core root of what makes an idea spreadable. And so I think their thing was like, success was with the letters. Let me see if I can remember them all. It was it had to be simple. It had to be unexpected. Like there had to be a twist to it. It has to be concrete. It has to be, which I translate as spoken in nouns, like dictionary word pictures. So basically, if you think about in the dictionary, if you go to typewriter, you can picture what that graphic's going to look like of a typewriter. So if you can communicate your ideas in words that other people can hopefully picture immediately, they're much stronger.
But this brings us back to the whole digital mock-up thing, like when the client can't see anything because of the ears being cut out wrong, and
right.
And suddenly you're trying to explain like really hilarious scripts, and we used to just act those out and the clients could like sort of get it from there. But now it's like, well, it's going to be really funny with this little girl who parks her bicycle like a badass cop or something, and it's a tricycle with extra wheels. You're just stealing that junk off of YouTube because it's easier to show them really funny clips than to explain that we're going to make a really funny clip.
Yeah.
And movies have been made really funny where somebody had to explain that this movie was going to be made before it was made. So I don't know if we've lost the art of selling or if the clients have lost the trust.
It's probably two parts of both. The clients have lost the trust because we've stopped earning it, because we've started presenting that way. Like you talked about the challenge of the art director. Think about how the prevalence of the stock photo sites changed what our job was.
Yeah.
Right? Like now that everybody has a Shutterstock account, now all photography is weird Eastern European photography, it adds, just because that's what they have to offer. And it used to be we would look through, I already forgot all the brands that Getty Images bought. Photonica. Remember how you had to get down that big Photonica book that was like an annual, and you just, would kind of try to find any picture that was close to what you wanted.
Yeah.
And they were all gorgeous shots too.
Yeah.
And now we see Instagram photos and get inspired by that on Tumblogs. But all the sort of watering down and making more common of that, and then our accessibility to sites like CompFight, Google Images, and Shutterstock, we feel like if we can make it concrete for the client, we should, even if it's off the mark. And to your point, we've lost the ability to draw. Or, at my first job, I went in the back room, and they were like, we got to clean out this back room. And we threw away carts and carts of amazing marker drawings. Unbelievable.
Before I got my first art director job, I was moonlighting as the storyboard illustrator.
And I
know other art directors who are really, really good at comp artists as well. But, you know, and then they're being used by their agencies as comp artists. And then I know one of them, he said, sure, I can do that. I can turn it around for you by tomorrow and it'll be so and so much per hour.
Yeah.
He knew that, you know.
Commoditized himself. But he said, if you're going to make me be the storyboard artist, you're going to pay me as a storyboard artist.
Exactly. Yeah. And more power to him because, yeah. If you are the storyboard artist, then you should charge for it because that used to be a career.
Right. Yeah. Only at Pixar now.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, like the technology disrupted us as creatives. And I think we have to then find our own ways of disrupting ourselves and adding that value back in. And I think the way to do that is to have a leg up on where your ideas are going to go. So like, you know, Nate Distick had these six characteristics. Let's change those a little bit and apply them to the ad world so that when we're making concepts, we can know if we're hitting against those six. And then we can know even before we pitch it to our creative director, is this going to be a good idea or not? We can sell it on those merits. So when you're pitching an idea, you can say, is it clear what the band, you know, they had story was a big thing in Made to Stick. But I think that's the USP. That's the plot of the ad. That's the single proposition, right?
Yeah.
Same deal. Make it really clear. The twist has to be there. We know that. We're always looking for that. And I think a lot of times all we're looking for is the twist. All we're looking for.
Yeah, because you have to make it interesting. I mean, you have the thing that you're going to sell, but you have to make it interesting because or else it won't stick in the minds of people.
Mm-hmm. And but we forget about some of the other ones that they talk about. Credibility, which either, you know, you need facts and figures or it needs to ring true.
Yeah. This is really important. I mean, this is, you saw who, Levinson died this week.
Yeah.
And what he had written for Time, there was a pitch for Time magazine in 1960. Every single word of that still rings true.
The human element, right? I mean, it wasn't just stats and figures. It was kind of the Ronald Reagan, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? A question you can ask yourself and answer to yourself.
I'm gonna link it in the blog post because what he wrote needs to be read. But it's like he was just saying if we don't tell the truth, we're killing ourselves. One skilled word at a time.
Yeah. So he was saying the ad was about Time magazine being truthful.
No, it was just a pitch about advertising. So I don't know why this ad was made exactly, but what he was saying is that advertising as a business will kill itself if it isn't truthful.
Yeah. If it isn't true to the heart too, not just true to factual.
Yeah, exactly. We can't, you know, we can't be saying this is an awesome product when in fact it isn't. And it's like we are actually the problem solvers. And this goes back to the way that agencies used to be partners with companies. And they aren't anymore. I mean, they should be partners. It's not just the creative stuff to sell their product. It's also we are problem solvers. We might see something that we could work with their research and development team to expand or take further.
Right. Exactly.
And I think this is really important that every brief is a creative trying to solve a problem in the brief. And then every brief itself is trying to solve another problem. You know, that's what we're doing. I mean, I came from a background of I knew how to draw and I was a Sherlockian. So all I ever wanted to do was solve problems. And then that turned me into an art director. That's how it worked.
Did you say you were a Sherlockian?
Yeah.
You were in the style of Sherlock Holmes? Is that
no, a Sherlockian is a Sherlock Holmes geek.
Oh, I see. No, I love Sherlock too. No, I think that's a good point.
I was reading those books because you want to know who did it and what happened and how it, and you're looking for clues all over the place. So that was like sort of an obsessive thing. So first brief, we didn't even have briefs. I'm trying to figure out what's not selling, how is it not selling, where could it be, what. And so it was the same thing. And I was like, this is interesting. I could do this. I could make this my job. It would be fun. And plus, I use markers all the time. I thought. And then, boom, everything changed.
Well, now you get to click all the time. But you learn to love it. You learn to like Photoshop. But, I love what you're saying about the problem-solving of it. And we know always that that's where the good ideas are, too, is that it can't just be the joke. I stumbled upon this analogy, and now I'm going to bury it here at the end of this, but I know I'm going to bring it up again. a lot in the future because I really like it. But it feels like a lot of times in advertising, we're just building that Western movie set where it's just the front of the buildings, you know, and they're just propped up and you go behind them and it was just, there's nothing there. And that's what happens if you're not doing problem solving. That's what happens if you're not really addressing the whole business need. And I think consumers feel that too. When you see that, the first time you've seen that about the Western set and you look behind it, you feel ripped off, right? Yeah. You feel like you've been duped. You feel like, why did I fall for this? And that's what every commercial kind of does, because there's no way that within 30 seconds in between what you'd rather be doing that we can give you an experience that's going to be as rich as what we're telling the story of, right? So we're always telling you a bigger story and we're always creating a bigger facade than what the actual use of the product is going to pay off with. No matter how many beers I've drank, the cute girls never come up to me, right? Because of the beer.
Well, then the beer goggles aren't working.
But, you know, you want that to happen so bad that you keep it up and keep going, because the hole that's created by that ad, that a cute girl should be coming up to me, I'm looking for that all the time. The beer can't fill that hole, other than deadening my emotions or whatever. But the beer can't be the substitute for that experience for me.
Yeah, and the beer can certainly not make it snow when you twist the cap either.
If that was the case, I'd be closing beers around here. We're about to get nailed with a lot of snow. Yeah. But no, exactly. You know, we're always creating these massive sort of holes in the psyche of what you'd really wish would happen, and then filling it with this tiny little cork of the product. How can we, and I think maybe this is a good sort of button to put on this, how can we as creatives always be looking for ways to build that whole house? To create that whole experience, what's missing in the product and how does the product itself maybe need to change?
Yeah.
And we feel like that's a planning's job or account services job, but we're the problem solvers. We're the Sherlockians.
Yeah. It was never, no offense to planners that I know, but it was never the planner's job to me. It was always my job. I'd receive the brief. The brief would suck. I would rewrite it because it needs to have a bigger solution. And that's the only way I can start on a brief. I rewrite the whole brief.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe, you know, next episode we can talk about some tactics of rewriting briefs, specific concrete ways to do it. Maybe throw a worksheet up on the site even. So cool. Yeah, I think that's a good title for this one too. We are the Sherlockians.
All right. Cool. We are the Sherlockians.
All right. All right. Until next week, Ask. This was really great.
All right. See ya.
We'll talk then.
Thank you.